This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. What to do about short-term vacation rentals? It's a question in many cities and communities in different parts of the world, and certainly a contentious issue here in Hawaii. Yesterday, the Honolulu City Council appeared set to vote on new rules for Oahu, spent much of the day in debate, but last night, the vote was delayed. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was down at the council meeting and is here with an update. And Ryan, another active discussion.
Yeah, that's right, Bill. These are always very emotional events whenever the city council or the planning commission has a hearing on this. Very emotional from both sides of the issue as well, both for and against short-term rentals. Yesterday was kind of different in the sense that confusion was maybe the most prevailing emotion. There were two bills that the city council was looking at. They've gone through several different revisions over the past 6 months or so, and we've had well over a dozen versions of these two bills together, and they were coming very quickly. The council was really trying to move forward on this, coming out of the legislative session when some tax legislation was passed on short-term rentals. And you could tell even some of the lawmakers at Honolulu Hale couldn't keep up with the different versions. They were having to decide which of several different versions to advance, which ones to leave by the wayside. And that was really the case for a lot of the people who showed up to offer comments, including for Jenny Kono. She's a Kahala resident and manages legal vacation rentals.
And I don't think it's fair that the council are proposing all these amendments at the last second, as late as this morning, and are going to be voting on them today. If there are laws that are going to affect people's lives, the citizens whose lives will be affected need to know about it, and they need to be able to have time to come here and testify about it.
And she was obviously against strict regulation on vacation rentals, but that kind of sentiment was the case for people on both sides of the issue yesterday. Just a lot of confusion in general and anger and kind of feeling upset with the lawmakers for how the process was handled. One of the other big sources of frustration is that Oahu is really the last island, the last county to kind of make movement on this issue. The other counties besides the city and county on Honolulu have been moving to change the way they regulate vacation rentals. And Oahu's situation has really been kind of difficult. And so there were these two bills that were under consideration. One was very restrictive and one was less so. The bill that was a little bit less so is numbered 89, and it originated from Mayor Kirk Caldwell, Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell, and his Department of Permitting and Planning. They did months and months of public hearings, consulted with outside members or independent members of the Honolulu Planning Commission, who gave a lot of feedback and put together this bill that was meant to be a compromise and sort of give both sides something, leave everybody not quite happy, but try and move forward.
That sense, you know, you talked about the confusion there. And again, this has been going on for some time. It's not like everybody showed up yesterday and there were some changes. And yet, in terms of the bills themselves, there's confusion about what was in there.
Yeah. And I think for me, I've been following this for about a year now, and I'm kind of confused by it still. We started with these two bills that were pretty different. One was that compromise bill we talked about from the mayor. The other came from Councilmember Ron Manor, and that was number 85. And that was seen as much more hard line. It would not have allowed any vacation rentals, short-term rentals outside of Waikiki and resort areas. It would allow neighbors to sue their neighbors that are operating illegal rentals. And what's happened over the past several months since the council got these bills is that they've gradually become more and more similar as council members have adjusted the language to fit their own feelings and their own proclivities. And what we were left with was two bills that weren't all that different. 89 would have allowed for some vacation rentals outside of the resort areas, not a ton, about 1,700 island-wide, and it's estimated there's anywhere between 10 and 20,000 right now. So still a pretty significant reduction. But the bills became very similar, and I think that was part of the reason people were so confused, as there was cross-pollination between the two. But a lot of people did show up to voice support for one or the other, or neither was very common. Governor Neil Abercrombie, former Hawaii Governor Neil Abercrombie, addressed the council yesterday as a private citizen, and he supported the more hardline measure.
Let me tell you, there are law firms in this city, in this state, right now, that are going to probably be put on retainer. They are going to be able to massacre any individual that tries to raise any issue of violation, anything that's taken up by the Department of Planning at this particular time. There's going to be an explosion of illegal rentals going on despite the best efforts of Bill 89. We are on the edge of an explosion of illegal rentals that are going to take place if we allow this to go forward. I plead with you. I know your intentions are good. I know your intentions are valuable. Pass Bill 85. And if not defeating Bill 89, take Bill 89 back to committee. I don't think 89 is going to enable us to be able to meet the kind of standard of enforcement that I think we all intend to have.
Former Hawaii Governor Neil Abercrombie there, obviously advocating for a tougher stance on short-term rentals. Part of the reason, Bill, that these two bills became so similar is that there have been some court decisions in other cities in the country in recent months that have set legal precedents for how cities and states can regulate this industry. So both bills have been tweaked to incorporate that. Provisions have been borrowed from one or the other. So there was still that confusion. You just kind of heard Governor Abercrombie there saying he liked one more than the other. Maybe the other one needed tweaking. But opponents of restricting short-term rentals hate both of these bills. They were originally more open to 89, the compromise bill, but it's sort of moved more towards the crackdown side of the spectrum. And they're really, really against both of these bills. A lot of them are business owners that are either managing properties or servicing vacation rental properties. One of those was Terry Lodge, who owns a small cleaning company called IRC Cleaning. They employ about 13 people. And he was pretty stark when he told council members how his business would be affected.
I go under. That's it. I go under, and so do most of the other small businesses that are here and not here. We all go under. I've spent the past year building my team at IRC Cleaning, promising futures, training leaders. I've gotten to know their kids, their spouses, their moms, and their dads. Not only do I get the pleasure of watching all of you sever their futures, I get to hang around and navigate the murky waters with the owners and hosts as they adjust their lives too. And what about the 10 additional staff that I intended to hire at IRC per year for the next 3 years? That's 30. Whether it's appreciated or not, everybody has benefited from TVUs. Admit it. Whether you want to admit it, whether you like it or not, everybody has benefited in one way or the other. The future of this island's economic growth was in your hands. Now its demise and failure lie solely on you.
Terry Lodge's assertion there being that this industry, short-term rentals, have been a big growth sector of Hawaii's economy and that everybody benefits from that certainly could be disputed by people on the other side. But he told me, Terry, that that 85% of his business comes from short-term rentals. They do some other work with schools and construction sites, but so that would really be disastrous for them if there was a big crackdown. And he mentioned those murky waters. That's kind of a nod to the fact that neither one of these bills has much in the way of enforcement provisions.
And that's one of the keys to come back to. I mean, you mentioned figures earlier, but we don't even know how many illegal rentals. The estimate's 10 to 20,000.
Yeah, it depends on who's
doing
take,
the counting. Yeah. Right. But the idea that this is a force already here in the community and it exists. And so if you're the council members at this point, what's the starting point that they go back to committee to talk about?
Really hard to say, Bill. I don't envy them at all because there are no good solutions here if they're trying to serve the best interests of the most people, which is what you would want. I mean, one study from Expedia Group, which owns several short-term rental booking platforms, said this is a $1.2 billion industry on Oahu. 7,000 jobs could be lost from these bills, they estimate. Obviously, they have skin in the game, but it's going to be really hard for lawmakers to find something that works for everybody. And Mayor Caldwell acknowledged that when he kind of presented this compromise bill originally, saying that there are no solutions that will satisfy everybody. And I think that is going to have to be there. They're going to have to sort of swallow the bitter pill and accept that they're going to make a lot of people angry no matter what they do.
We'll see what comes next. And Ryan, you'll be on that story.
Sure will. Thanks
very much,
Bill.
Ryan Finnerty, you can find more on Ryan's coverage on this story and more at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
This week on Says You.
Everybody in the audience knows this. This is humbling to have all these questions and have everybody in the audience know it. But only the people on the panel not know it. Well, this is certainly an experience in humility.
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner, says you.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Hundreds of years ago, Native Hawaiians bathed in the ocean when they were sick. Specific locations were believed to be sacred and spiritual and were revered for their healing properties. While on these shorelines, the sick would weave seaweed or limukala into lei. Then they would wear that lei and wade into the ocean to ask forgiveness for their wrongdoings. They believed their physical ailments were manifestations of those wrongdoings. So the questions for today's backyard quiz: can you name one of those healing spots in Waikiki and identify a recognizable landmark that now stands nearby? We'll have the answer later in the program. If you know it, you can call 941-3689 or Neighbor Islands 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. Trey Somble and Scott Janisch perform Magnuson's new commission, Na Ko Elua, and Mozart's Oboe Quartet, May 20th at Doris Duke Theater. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
Ramadan started this week. It's an important part of the Muslim faith, a month-long commemoration of the Prophet Muhammad receiving the first verses of the Quran from God, Allah. There is fasting during daylight hours, and for many outside the Muslim faith, that may be as much as you know about it. Our next guest is here to add some context. Hakimo Ansafi is president of the Muslim Association of Hawaii and joining us from our studios in Honolulu this morning. Aloha. Thanks for
coming. Aloha to you. Good morning.
So to begin with, how would you characterize the starting point of the significance of Ramadan?
Ramadan is the ninth month of the lunar calendar, and it is one of the pillars of Islam. There are five pillars. This is the fourth pillar, which basically, as you have eloquently stated, is abstaining from food from sunrise to sunset during the daylight for any adult, healthy adults. Must participate in this, but it goes beyond that. I think the abstention from eating, drinking as well, sexual relations, and also the fasting of the tongue from saying or doing any hurtful things, and the of the feet from walking to things that you're not supposed to. It's more of a spiritual boot camp cleansing for 30 days.
It's a very reflective period as well.
Indeed, I think that is the purpose of it. The Holy Quran says that the month of Ramadan was prescribed to you as it has been prescribed to those before you, so that you may attain God consciousness and self-control. So in effect, it is all about that, to keep God in mind. And by extension, anything that you experience, you reflect on it. For example, you feel hunger, So you must reflect on the poor people and the hungry people, not just in this island or this country, but worldwide, that they are hungry, not because of observing Ramadan, but because they are not able to do so. It's also a reflection on the sick and those who are unprivileged. So for that 30 days of self attaining purity and consciousness to increase your morality and to increase your consciousness of others, not just yourself, really results in something beautiful at the end, which is being able to open up and give generously from your wealth to those who are not as lucky as you are, those kind of things. So it is all about self-reflection and attaining that God consciousness and self-control.
And there is that quietness and reflectiveness, as you say, attached to that. And yet it's not, for people outside the faith sometimes in terms of understanding it, there are aspects, it's not somber necessarily, because there's very much a social aspect to this as well, particularly when the sun goes down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there's a verse of the Quran that says we have created humanity so that they may know one another. So there is one other aspect that we practice during this month. All Muslims are encouraged to reach out to their neighbors, to their community, Muslims and non-Muslims, and just to practice that aspect of a religion that during the other 11 months, you're extremely busy. You don't have a chance to do it. So it's a happy month. It is not about the hunger. It is not about the thirst. And there is verses in the Quran that specifically says that. It is about the purity and the consciousness that you get out of it so you can give back, not only to your immediate family, but also to your community in general, your neighbors and parents and everybody else. So it's a happy time, you know, and that is why if you are sick and elderly and the children under the age of puberty and all of that, they are not allowed to fast because it's not about the hunger or the thirst. It's about the benefits that you get from it. There are certainly health benefits because during that month you try not to stuff yourself with a lot of impurities that you would otherwise do. But it is, I think, to be able to be a good human being as God has intended you to be, to yourself by being good to yourself through your health and self-consciousness or reflection, to your immediate family by spending what is called iftar at the sunset. You get together with your family and your neighbors and your community and you breakfast together and talk. And then you extend it outside that by making sure that you give that sense of aloha, sense of beauty to others around you.
And there is a universality to a lot of what you're talking about. And you used the word aloha. And when you came, I not wanting to offend being outside the faith myself, but it's a salam alaikum, and peace be upon you, is the traditional greeting. And there are a lot of things within the Muslim faith that extend and can be lessons to those even outside the faith.
Yeah, no, 100%. Islam is, it's not this separate, different religion. I think our commonalities are millions and our differences are couple. And I think the issue that we see sometimes around the world is people are concentrating on the differences and not the commonalities. So, salamu alaikum, as you have said, basically means peace be upon you. And I think we'd love to be greeted by that. And we greet our Muslims and non-Muslims friends. And the response to that is wa alaikum salam, and unto you is the peace. So, yes, it's a lot of commonalities.
That that does bring me, though, to not everyone is so welcome. It takes me to the Muslim ban of the Trump administration, so-called. State of Hawaii took part in a lawsuit challenging that, and among the evidence cited, there was impact on the community here. That went through the legal process, and the Trump administration was upheld. What's your sense now of where we are with that? What impact are you seeing? Do you anticipate? And how has that gone?
Well, I think the unfriendliness of this administration expands far beyond just the Muslims. Certainly with what we've seen at the borders for non-Muslims, immigrants that just trying to come here to do good for their families. And so we've seen a lot of nonsense, a lot of hatred, a lot of division. Islam is completely and totally against that. And that's why we participated in the lawsuit. We do believe that we have to have very strong borders. We do believe that we have to have great immigration policies and follow the laws and the rules. But when you stop people because of their race, nationality, gender, then we as Muslims, as well as other people of conscience, we have to speak up against it.
You know, I'm struck. You talk about violence as well, and I have to mention the march, the attack on the mosques in New Zealand. I was struck by a Facebook posting that you put up reacting to the response that you got from the community here in Hawaii about that. I just was going to read part of it. Our prophet taught us that those who do not thank people do not thank God. Thank you for all your kind words of support, flowers being there for our community during these difficult times. Comforted and grateful by the overwhelming support and kind wishes, wanted to take a moment to acknowledge how blessed we are to live among such a community as this one. We can only hope that other communities in the United States and abroad can experience the level of aloha found in Hawaii. It brings people together in the face of adversity and makes us stronger as peace-loving community more than ever. Thank you and aloha, Hakim. That sense of being within this community in Hawaii, very much part of your community.
Absolutely. I think we are one, and that came from the heart, what's been written there. We meant every word of it. The sense of aloha and peace and love that we have received as a result of the tragedy in New Zealand was very much appreciated. And we were hoping that our administration in Washington would have at least been inspired by the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who showed how to handle situations like that. But we are very, very grateful. We are part of this community, will always be. And to see that sense of brotherhood and sisterhood, it's always heartwarming.
Hakim, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And Ramadan Mubarak.
And same to you. Thank you.
Hakim Olansafi is president of the Muslim Association of Hawaii. The state of Hawaii keeps a list of people confirmed to have neglected or abused their children, or to have put them at risk of neglect or abuse. But what if your name got on that list undeservedly? A Honolulu woman says that's what happened to her, and now it's having consequences for one of her lifetime dreams. Honolulu Civil Beat Investigations editor John Hill has that story online this morning at civilbeat.org and joins us now to talk about it. John, this story seems to begin with a woman, her two kids, and a physically abusive boyfriend.
That's right. She had a man that she had met in high school that she reconnected with, and shortly into their relationship, he began to beat her, and the state of Hawaii at one point took away her children, saying that she had failed to prevent them from seeing the violence between them. She denies that that's the case. She says that the kids never saw violence and he was never violent with them.
And one of the keys to this story, she didn't get a notification of this in a time that was within a window of appeal, basically.
That's right. At that time, this was in 2012, 2013, the state of Hawaii was not sending notices to everybody who was being put on this registry. And so she was one of the people who never got a notice. So she went through the whole process that she was told to go through to regain custody of her children, which she did, and never got a notice saying, hey, you're going to be on this registry and this is going to have these ramifications for the rest of your life.
And that idea in terms of the child abuse registry, I don't know in terms of any sense of how many were put on without notice, but you do have figures on how often that list is referred to, checked by potential employers, some by law, some by practice, and by others as well.
Yeah, and what's happened with these registries in Hawaii and also the other states is that they were originally meant to be sort of an internal list that social workers and doctors and people like that could check to see if there had been a pattern of abuse involving a certain person. And over time, legislatures, including Hawaii's, have sort of expanded the use of the registry so that now if you're going to work in a healthcare facility, for instance, you have to undergo one of these checks through the registry.
And that takes us back to the theme of the broken dream, really, in terms of this woman wanting to be a nurse and now potentially being barred from doing that.
That's right. When she was growing up, she decided she wanted to become a nurse because her grandmother was a certified nursing assistant, and she used to follow her on her rounds and learn to use a stethoscope and saw how much people appreciated what her grandmother was doing and sort of vowed at that moment that she, too, was going to become a nurse. And it was only years after her child custody case had closed that she saw something online indicating that this registry existed. And she said, uh-oh, I better check that and see if I'm on this registry. And she was told that she was. She was on the registry for life and that she had been sent a letter telling her as much when it happened. She's very, very scrupulous about keeping all the documents from her record and went through them, and she didn't find a notice. And finally, she got the state to admit they had not sent it to her. What they did at that point was they sent her a new notice dated the week that she asked about it, but she has no right of appeal.
And that, at this point, for her and in this case, is troubling on the one hand of not having a route of appeal, but also in terms of others who may be facing similar situations.
That's true. The state of Hawaii does not really know how many people did not receive these notices before 2015, but I've been contacted by at least one person already today who said that she's in the same boat. So it's a big question mark how many other people are similarly situated. There is a class action lawsuit going through the federal courts involving a plaintiff by the name of Courtney Bird that is reviewing some of these same issues and trying to get relief for this group of people who never did receive a notice.
John, thanks very much. John Hill, the Civil Beat Investigations Editor. John, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a compelling story. It's a good read. It's at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Diamond Head Theater, the all-female Beehive, the 60s musical, journeys through the decade with songs such as The Name Game and Natural Woman, opening May 17th, diamondheadtheater.com.
Miranda Dinda used to believe false claims that vaccines could harm her child. She doesn't anymore.
It seemed like I had just found this secret information that only some people come across, and I thought, why would I not use this information?
How we know what's true, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7, right after Says You.
One persistent problem for ocean pollution is plastic, especially microplastic, which also winds up on beaches around the world and across our state. This week, the Department of Land and Natural Resources is trying out a new weapon in the war against microplastic pollution. It's a machine that sucks up microplastic from the sand. It's called Hula One, and one of the co-founders of the company behind it, Samuel Duvall, joins us to tell us more.
Hi.
Samuel, welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, explain a bit how this works. It looks, honestly, sort of like a giant rolling vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, so it's like a big trailer. So we have a vacuum system on it. So you have one person that take the vacuum tool to go on the beach, and you can suck all the mixture of sand and plastic. So all the mix is going through the machine, and then it goes on the upper tank. It drops on a big tank that we filled up with water from the sea. And we can put all the mixture of plastic and sand on this big tank. So with the water, we can separate all the plastic and the sand. So all the plastic is going up, and all the sand is sink. So basically, we are creating an overflow. So we can pick up all the plastic, and we can put back all the clean sand on the beach.
And that's that separation, that ability to separate is the key of what makes this different.
Yeah, exactly, because all the plastic arrive from the ocean, so it floats. So we can all separate it from the sand by doing this.
And you figured this out. I mean, this is, you put together, I love this, it's 12, it was a class project, 12 mechanical engineering students, of which you're one.
Yeah.
And how did that all go?
Yeah, so it started 2 years ago. One of our friends saw a lot of videos and documentaries about the plastic issue. And he saw a video of Camilo Point here in Big Island. So he told us that he wanted to create a machine to help them to clean the beaches. So we contacted Hawaii Wildlife Fund, and they told us the real problem is that they are not able to pick up all the small pieces of plastic and the microplastic.
Too small. The plastic is too small physically to pick up. I should point out, by the way, just you're coming to Hawaii, but from the University of Sherbrooke in Quebec.
Exactly, right? So. Canada. So. Yeah, all the microplastic, like, you cannot pick them all with your hand. It will be very too long. And we did some research, and we realized that there were no machine existing around the world to do this kind of job. So we told each other we will invent it, and we did it. So now we tested the last 2 weeks of April in Big Island on Camilo Point. And at first, the first test we did, for sure, it's a prototype, so everything wasn't going well, but we had some time to fix all the problem we had and did some modification. So at the end, we were pretty happy with the machine that we gave to Hawaii Wildlife Fund.
So you're leaving the machine behind to do some work for us.
Here. Yeah, it's a donation that we do to Hawaii Wildlife Fund. And right now we are in Honolulu, and three of us are working full time on this project right now. So we finished the school in December, and three of us want to expand our technology and to clean other beaches, because we know it's a big problem, and there's a lot of beaches here in Oahu that has the same problem also. So we have been meeting over the past week a lot of nonprofit organizations of beach cleanup, mm-hmm. and also government, the person from the association, and maybe also some funders that could help us to develop other machines.
At one point, of course, there's a big financial aspect of this. I mean, it's, you know, no secret. You're trying to raise money in terms of making this go as a commercial venture. It's interesting. I was seeing that you have some corporate interest in this project, including an Italian company, Prenoth. They make snow grooming machines and other tracked vehicles like that. But that's an interesting combination that you would capture part of that attention, but from a mechanical engineering standpoint, probably that makes sense.
Yeah, and for sure it can be interesting, because they are doing like a tracking. So, and as our machine is going on the beaches, maybe it could be an option to be partner with them. So we would see for the future. Yeah, but it's nice to see that there's a lot of interest around all the companies and. Also, what we want to make sure is that what we're doing right now, it's not a reason to continue to consume all the plastic we are doing right now. Like one of our friends is used to say, it's kind of sad that we have to invent this machine, because it's a big problem, and we did all this problem by consuming a lot of plastic. So what we're trying to do is to fix the problem we already did, but the main thing that we have to do is to stop consuming that much plastic.
And to attack the problem further upstream.
Exactly.
Before it winds up in the oceans and on the beaches and all of that. It's interesting when you talk about studying in Quebec, again, coming to Hawaii for this. Why? And I understand about seeing some of the video, but how did you settle on coming to Hawaii? I mean, there are oceans closer to where you were.
Yeah, you could think it's because of the weather, but it's not. We wanted to do a project that helped the environment, and we did a lot of research, and Kamilo, it's one of the dirtiest beaches around the world. So by cleaning this beach, we think that we can have a major impact, and if we're able to clean this beach, I think that we can clean every beach around the world. So we started by contacting Hawaii Wildlife Fund, and they were willing to help us to give some information about the beach, and then we started the project.
And so what, in terms of your views of defining success, and I know that that's a moving target, but in terms of what will be successful for you in terms of cleaning up the beach?
It's that there's no more plastic on the beaches. That's the ultimate goal. And if we can help, because we want to use our engineering skills to help to save the planet. So if by doing that we can resolve this problem, that would be the successful thing that we want to do.
So you're here in Hawaii for about a last couple of weeks and a little bit more from now. What comes next for you?
So the reason why we want to meet most of people as possible is to know what is the real need and what can we do for a better machine that can be more convenient to them and that will be more used. So this is what is coming next. We want to try a partner that will work with us to develop a new machine and eventually to bring machines to the other Hawaiian islands, because it's a problem that you have everywhere in Hawaii. So this is the next step for the future.
Well, thanks for coming to Hawaii to help out.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Samuel Duvall, co-founder of the company behind Hula One, a new machine designed to suck up microplastics off the beach. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the 2019 Maui Classical Music Festival, featuring music of Beethoven, Mozart, and more, 7 p.m. tomorrow at Makawao Union Church. MauiClassicalMusicFestival.org.
Earlier in the program, we told you about a Waikiki location where Native Hawaiians used to gather limukala to weave into lei, and then wearing the lei, wade into the ocean to cleanse themselves of physical and spiritual illness. We asked you to name the area as well as a prominent structural landmark located nearby. The site, called Kawehewehe, is found on a tiny section of beach fronting the Halekulani Hotel. Today, Native Hawaiians and island residents still seek the healing powers of the ocean, but few come to that spot anymore. Here's some interesting facts about the seaweed. Besides being revered for its healing properties, its young leaves are edible, often used to stuff fish. The leaves can also be cleaned, dried, deep-fried in hot oil to make limukala chips. And as one would expect, in the melting pot of Hawaii, Chinese herbalists use powdered limukala dissolved in warm water to drink as tea. Purpose, to remove excess phlegm. Thanks to Diana Ko for this piece of history. That is today's quiz, although we had no winners today. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Where words fail, music speaks. That's a line from Hans Christian Andersen, but it's a feeling that's shared by many. Nothing quite like live music. Our arts and culture reporter Noe Tanigawa here with some musical options.
Oh, you're so right about that, Bill. You know, a lot of us kind of fail on getting out to hear live music.
Yeah, that's true.
And we don't even notice it drops out of our lives. Well, there's a lot going on in Honolulu, and a few of the selections I'd like to play today were all happening in 1 week here.
Nice.
All right, let's start, if you're ready, at UH Manoa, a concert given by the UH Contemporary Music Ensemble. It's led by director Thomas Osborne. He's also an associate professor of composition up there. Now, he introduced the concert saying, just listen, don't applaud between the pieces, just listen and applaud at the end. So the concert started with the first movement of John Cage's Suite for Toy Piano. This piece was written in 1948. This was the first piece, Bill, to fully establish the toy piano as a bona fide instrument.
Certainly a different sound.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's a sound that John Cage liked. I mean, the reason it sounds so different from a regular piano is it's plastic hammers striking on little metal bars. Mm. So the plinkiness and the limited range is what John Cage was going for. Perfect. Yeah. In this concert now, movements from this Suite for Toy Piano were inserted kind of like palate cleansers in between each of the courses. Okay? Now check out this music. Okay, when you go in, it's experiential above all things, and this one, this piece is called Stillness by Korean composer Seongyong Park. It's for flute, piano, cello, percussion, haegeum, a fiddle that you bow on your knee, and gayageum, a zither. Looks like a koto. What we're listening to, actually, is called contemporary art music, or contemporary classical. It's basically, it's kind of music wrestling its way out of the Western classical tradition. Mm. And Philip Glass, one of the major figures, liked to say he, quote, immersed the listener in a sort of sonic weather. You know?
That's a great phrase.
Yeah, it is. And Professor Osborne realizes when people walk into a contemporary classical concert, they're in for stuff they may not have ever heard before. And he's really sympathetic.
You just have to listen to every piece on its own terms. Come with an open mind, of course, but know that when you sit down and listen to a piece of contemporary classical music, you're not going to be hearing anything that sounds like Beethoven. You're going to expect to hear new sounds and new colors and new ways of playing instruments and perhaps even new instruments.
Yeah. Well, you know, I almost feel like I hear perversity, like people refusing to sound tuneful. Like...
Yeah, I think a number of composers would say, sure, you know, my music is not meant to be tuneful. And for a good period of the 20th century, there were composers who actively wrote not to be tuneful. But, you know, in the 21st century, I think composers have relaxed a little bit. They're a little less dogmatic about such things, and I'd say today no composer would feel embarrassed to write a great tune.
And that's kind of a relief, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, because some of this can tend to sound a little bit alarming. The UH Contemporary Music Ensemble closed with Tom Flaherty's Igor to Please, two grand pianos, two standard pianos, two toy pianos, and electronics. It was really something.
Wow.
Young Osborne and his contemporary music crew are combining instruments from Eastern and Pacific cultures. They're building repertoire. They're creating a niche. You know, they're creating a niche that we could be good at here.
You really hear those Asian influences, too, as part of that whole package, really.
You do. And we've got, you know, people from those cultures, people who are actually good at playing those instruments here in Hawaii, composing music that combines, you know, Pacific and Asian instruments.
Yeah, nice.
It's neat. It's what's happening in the composition department up at UH. This concert I asked Terry what he thought of it. He said, well, technically, it was well done. But who could tell? Yeah. You know, I mean, in a sense, it's kind of like that.
Right, right.
But what it points out, Bill, is the commitment of the musicians. It really has a lot to do with it. And I just enjoyed this night.
That's
great. Fun up there. All right, now you're ready for a little something different.
Mm-hmm.
That same week, the HPU International Chorale and International Vocal Ensemble, the Windward Choral Society, Kapolei High School Hurricane Singers, and members of the Hawaii Symphony performed at St. Andrew's Cathedral. Beautiful setting. This is the HPU International Vocal Ensemble with Ikos by Galina Grigoryeva, a composer from Crimea. It's really neat where they find their influences. Now, another group there that was there that night was the Windward Choral Society. That's an incredibly strong group led by Susan McCrae Dupre, who also leads the Kona Choral Society. Now, these songs were based on melodies sung by the Crow tribe that lives in the Amazon of northwestern Brazil. This whole concert, free concert, concluded with Gabriel Fauré's Requiem. It was led by HPU choral director Alex Schumacher. Well over 100 voices there in St. Andrew's Cathedral, standing room only by the end. Windward Choral Society will perform selections from this foray and other works at their season finale that's coming up May 20th at St. John Vianney in Kailua. Another free concert there with over 100 voices.
Powerful.
Yeah, I know. It's just, you know, when I walked out, there were still people hanging around the outside of the cathedral. They had been standing for the entire concert, and they said, oh, we're so glad we came. And people were kind of running in the area, heard it, and stopped in. You could tell that. You know.
And diversity is a word that gets kicked around a lot, but sometimes not within the context of music. But what you just shared today just explodes with diversity.
I'm so glad you feel that way, because it does bring in Pacific, Asian, Western. It's all the different ways that we experience it through art. Really cool. And if you love Hawaiian music, by the way, my favorite place to hear it these days, you've been there, Vai Vai Collective.
Sure have.
Tonight, Imua Garza and Tifa, his wife, are great. It's going to be good.
That's great. And that's a great space to hear.
Fun?
Yes, it is. A great community space as well.
So many good places to hear live music. Let's do it.
That, of course, is Noe Tanigawa. She's HPR's arts and culture reporter. You can find her reports online at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Hi, this is Ku'uhaku Park. I'm with Mattson, and we're proud to be underwriters of HPR. HPR is such a unique entity and provides such a needed service to our community. What they bring to the table and their in-depth coverage of local issues, national issues, and international issues. I think it's very important, especially for a place that's as isolated as Hawaii.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's the program for today. Up tomorrow, Anote Tong, former president of Kiribati, joins us in studio to talk about rising sea levels for people in his country and region. It's not a theoretical exercise. This is changing lives. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave a comment in your voice. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman. Catherine's back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.